Okay. I'm Dan Connolly of the Athletic Baltimore. This here is a guy named Boog, Boog Powell. One of us will have a bobblehead at tonight's game given away, and one of us will be covering the game, so you guys can figure out which one's which. But the guy on my right really... The guy on my right needs no introduction. You know, more than 300 home runs, the All-Star Games, 70 MVP. But and I told him this in the back room. If you take away the six men who went into the Hall of Fame as an Oriole, that includes Earl. You can't forget Earl. And then the five players.
Especially Earl.
Yeah. I would make the argument, and I think most people here would agree with me, that this guy is, outside of those six, the most important player to ever wear an Orioles uniform.
Thank you.
I mean, this is a franchise goes back, the modern-day franchise goes back to 54. A lot of great players have passed through that. But if you take the ability of the player, the guy he was in the clubhouse, what he's been in the community, and probably most important, the winning that he brought, I think he truly is the greatest non-Hall of Famer in Orioles history. So, when I... Just to kind of start, because I wrote this book in 15, The 100 Things Orioles Fans Need to Know and Do Before They Die, and I talked to Boog for about an hour and 15 minutes. He gave me some great stories. But the one thing he gave me that absolutely shocked me and surprised me was that all these years we've been saying his nickname incorrectly. That actually his aunt, I guess, was the first one to coin it.
That's right.
And his nickname actually at the time as a child was Boog. Not Boog, but Boog. And that kind of
Brooks
evolved over time.
Says Boog, by the way.
So tell us a little bit about that, how that happened and why you stuck with Boog.
Well, my Aunt Eunice came to the house one time when I was quite young. I was like maybe 2 years old. And back, I grew up in Lakeland, Florida. And there was a radio show that ran every week down there. It was a local radio show called Dr. Boogit. So she came in the house one day and said, "Where's that little Boogit at?" And all of a sudden, it got shortened, you know, and it's all of a sudden, it's Boog. And that's all I knew my name as. And my teachers still call me John. My real name's John Wesley. And my teachers still call me that. They wouldn't call me Boog, but all my friends did and everybody else did. And, you know, when I finally got to the big leagues, I was standing out on the field one day, and Dizzy Dean was there. And they were doing the games back then with, I guess, Pee-wee Reese and Dizzy were doing the games. And Dizzy came over there, and he said, "Son, that's the worst nickname I have ever heard." That's the fact. Now, here's a guy named Dizzy. He's got a brother named Daffy. So he's talking about my name. Come on, give me a break, man. So it stayed Boog. And then all of a sudden, Major League Baseball started booing people and started doing this. And in Yankee Stadium, they were doing a thing for Moose Scourin. They were going, "Moose." So all of a sudden in Baltimore, started doing Boog. And I didn't discourage it. I loved it, you know. Because I knew when I was here, there was no G on the end. Or when I was in Yankee Stadium, right, there was no G on the end. But when I was here, there was a G on there. So anyway, we had a lot of fun with the name over the years. And it's been not embarrassing, but I've had to explain it sometimes when I really didn't want to explain it. So, and I didn't explain it. And there's other versions. There's other versions, and we can't do them here. So we had, you know, we just had a lot of fun with it. Anyway, thank you.
So he mentioned that he grew up in Lakeland. He was actually, it's kind of pertinent right now, because the Little League World Series is going on. Tomorrow we're going up to Williamsport.
Yep, that's right.
And Boog actually played in the Little League World Series for Lakeland, so not a lot of people
you
maybe
guys
knew that.
Know that, don't
right?
you? Yeah.
But his family moved to Key West, and at Key West, he was a three-sport athlete. He actually wanted to play for the Tigers, because that was the team that he cheered for out of Lakeland, obviously. But it was the St. Louis Cardinals, the Baltimore Orioles, and the University of Florida that were interested in Florida as a football player. But I think the Orioles gave him a little bit more money. So why baseball over football, and why the Orioles over the Cardinals?
Well, I was a pretty good football player. I was about 6'3", weighed about 230 in my senior year in high school, and I was an offensive and defensive lineman, which is, you know, that's the way it was done back in those days. And I was quite highly touted. I had all three of the service academies, Navy and Army and Air Force wanted me, and Alabama. Matter of fact, Bear Bryant pulled up to my house in Key West, Florida in a limousine and got out, and I was in the front yard, and he came over and he said, "Son, we want you to come to Alabama." I said, "Mr. Bryant?" He had the hat on, the whole thing, you know, the Bear Bryant thing. And I said, "Well, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Bryant." Got back in the car and left. In Key West, Florida, Bear Bryant was in my yard, you know. And anyway, everybody, I came up here and looked at Maryland. I did, you know, and of course I'd always been a Gator fan. I was always a University of Florida fan because my dad was and my family was, and it just, you know, that's the way it was. And so I signed, and then, but I told them when I signed, I said, "Now listen, the only reason I'm really signing this thing is if something happens that I can't play baseball." And so I went to the state tournament that year and had a really crappy state tournament. And we were the state champions. Key West won the state championship for the second year in a row. And I'd had a pretty good year. I think I hit 480 that year and, you know, hit 16 home runs in 30 games and drove in 40 runs or some crazy stuff like that, you know. And had good numbers and all of that. But right here in my heart, I wanted to play baseball. That's the bottom line. And I was going to be undeterred. So after the tournament, all of the people, I was going to be the next $100,000 bonus baby. I don't know if you guys remember Dave Nicholson. You remember Nick? Nick was the first $100,000 bonus, you know, guy. $100,000 in 1959. You know, that's pretty good money. It's pretty good money today too, but you know, back then it was real good. And I ended up, St. Louis came in, they offered me $20,000. Then the Orioles came right in behind it and offered me $25,000. I said, I went back to St. Louis again, they weren't going to go any higher. I said, "You got me." I signed a contract, went to Bluefield, West Virginia, and got up there and walked out on the field out there, and there's Dean Chance, Arnie Thorsland, all of these guys threw 100 miles an hour. And I got in the batting cage, and I had to hit off a Dean Chance, and I didn't even see the ball. What have I done? I have made a terrible mistake here. Oh, man. And I'm staying in a little hotel downtown by myself. I'm 17 years old, and I'm in the middle of nowhere. They gave me $470 a month to live on. So, you know, I had plenty of beer and all that stuff, you know. What the hell? 17-year-old kid, and all I did was go to the ballpark and play ball. That's all. And finally I started to catch up a little bit with the pitching and catch up with, you know, what was happening to me. And it was the start of something new. It was something big. So, you know, and the rest of it is kind of history. I went to Appleton, Wisconsin the next year, and I guess I should say I started off in Miami, and I hit 370 or something in spring training when I was 18, and Paul Richards was managing the Orioles back then, and Paul Richards called me into the office, and he said, "Son, I know you think you've made the team and everything else, but we're going to have to send you to the minors." And I went, "Yeah, okay." So they sent, see, and then he said, why don't you take a week off? I said, oh, okay. So I went from Miami down to Key West. It was about a three-hour drive. I got down to Key West, and I'm sitting there, and I said, what the hell am I doing? I'm a ball player. I got my car, drove from there to spring training, the Orioles minor league spring training in Thomasville, Georgia. And we stayed in the Army barracks. I was number 560. Nice little round number, yeah. And a week later, Earl Weaver was the man. Earl Weaver was a player manager in Appleton, Wisconsin, or Fox Cities, Wisconsin. He was a player manager, and he was quite fiery even back then. As a player manager and everything else, he was always into something. So we're playing in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. I'll never forget. And there's a big first baseman over there. I can't remember his name. But he hit a line drive at Earl, and Earl jumped up like that, and the ball hit him right there, right in the middle of the chest, knocked him out cold. There's Earl laying on the floor, like, on the ground like that. So me and Fody Anthony, who was our second baseman back then, we go over there, and we take our hats, and we're laughing at him, and we're, come on, you little bastard, get your ass out, you know. And so finally he got up, and he says, I quit. and he quit playing after that, and that's when he became the manager. And we won that league. I mean, we blew everybody away. I had Pete Ward and Dean Chance and Arnie Thorsland, and we had all the Oriole prospects back in those days, and Harry Dalton was doing his thing, and he loved Earl. And so Earl, you know, it was, you know, I get to the big leagues, Lumen Harris, they call me up in 61, at the end of the 61, and my first game is in Yankee Stadium. I'd been to Rochester the next year. I skipped a year. But I went to Yankee Stadium, and Bob Turley was a pitcher for the Yankees that day and struck me out my first at-bat. And then the second at-bat, I got a base hit back up the middle, drove in a run, and turns out at the end of the game, this was the winning run in that game in 1961. And it also turned out that I think Roger Maris hit number 58 in that game also. So, you know, off of Jack Fisher, I think. And, you know, it was a great memory. And that was the start of it. You know, I can go year by year or whatever you want to hear. What do you want to hear?
Let's go back to 60 for a second, because you told me a story, and I think it's an interesting story for everybody. So in 60 for spring training, you drive up with your dad to Miami from Key West.
That's right.
And who's the first guy you meet, the first guy that comes over? Tell us that story.
Yep, I got out of the car. My dad stopped, and I got out of the car, and there's Brooksy. And Brooksy came over to me and introduced himself to me. I knew who Brooks Robinson was, but I didn't. I'd never met him and been around him or anything else. So Brooksy walked over to my dad, and he said, don't worry, Mr. Powell, I will take care of him. So one of the greatest moments of my life, I never forgot that. And he took care of me a lot. And I took care of him some, too. Yeah. And we had a lot of fun. It was a great relationship. We went out the other night and over to Bill's Terrace Inn, and we had some of the prettiest crabs you ever saw. And Brooksy and I sat there, and we talked more or less like I'm talking to you right now. I mean, we were sitting there and just having a great time and had a couple of cool ones, and crabs were like that big. Oh, man. Oh, I miss doing that. And we don't have anything like that in Florida. I mean, we do have blue crabs in Florida, but they don't cook them and take care of them like they do up here. And we've got stone crabs down there. And my son, JW, and I, we had about 30 stone crab traps, and we used to get 40 or 50 pounds a week of stone crab claws. That's where this came from.
So take me to 66, because that's obviously the, you know, kind of the magic, where the magic really started beginning with you guys. 64, obviously a good year, but 66. Yeah. And there obviously was one major change in the roster in 66. And you weren't really sure. You told me you weren't really sure about Frank Robinson when he first came over.
Right.
And I believe it was you and Etch were watching him take batting practice one day.
That's right.
So tell us that story and tell us what that whole 66 season was like.
Well, to begin with, when we traded Milt Pappas, Milt Pappas was one of my really good friends, and he was a great guy, and he was a hell of a pitcher too. And I said, how the hell can we get rid of him? And we get Frank Robinson, 32 years old. You know, he can't help us. So anyway, we go to spring training. And I'm over there talking to Andy Etchebarren behind the cage, and Frank's in the cage, and he's hitting him over the palm trees. I says, Andy, I think we just won the pennant. Because we were pretty damn good, because, in 65, I mean, we made a pretty good showing. In 64, I think we finished in third place one game out, or two games out, in third place. And we were right there. And all of a sudden, here comes Frank, and we opened up, and he started driving the tack. And I kidded him a lot over the years, and I said, that's why they got me hitting behind you, because they don't want to walk you to get to me. They do not want to walk you. So he only hit 49 and drove in 140. And in late August of that year, I think when Frank had 38, I had 34, and I got hurt. Denny McClain hit me there and smashed that finger. I couldn't swing the bat for quite a while. But I still hit behind Frank. And we kidded about it. And Brooksy was there too. And then we get to the World Series, and we're in Dodger Stadium, and Don Drysdale's pitching. And I'd never faced him, but Frank had. And then Frank took him deep, and Brooksy took him deep. And I'm the next hitter, and I said, I'm going down. first at-bat in the World Series, I'm going down. He threw me a changeup. Yeah, and I still got a hernia from trying to stop. but anyway, no, we went ahead and we took it to him. Mo Drabowski came in. They got to McNally early in that first game. And then Mo came in and struck out 13. And from there on, later on, I got traded to the Dodgers my last year that I played in 77, and they said we were just tired. I said, yeah, we made you tired or two, didn't we? And we kidded a lot. I kid with it a lot. We had a lot of fun with it, and we were not only together on the field. That team reminds me a lot of what's happening to this Oriole team right now. And you see how they're together and how they're starting to click a little bit. And we started that same feeling that these guys, I can feel it in their bones because I was there. And it's really great to come to the ballpark every day knowing that you're going to kick somebody's ass. And they didn't even come out and watch us take batting practice. They didn't want to see that. So anyway, we played great defense, and that we didn't make any mistakes. We didn't beat ourselves, and it was a lot of fun. It was a great year.
So we had 66. I was joking with him that he was the third best player in 66 on his team and the third best player in the American League. It was Frank, Brooks, and Boog, 1, 2, 3 in the AL MVP voting, which is just incredible. And then in 69, he probably had what I think arguably might be your best year. But he finished second to Harmon Killebrew. So in 1970, he wasn't screwing around, and he wins the MVP. But you still think that 69 season might have been your best. So yeah. What did it feel like to finally get that MVP and kind of compare those 2 years?
Well, after 69 and the Mets beat us in the World Series that year, I still don't know how that happened, but they beat us. And I was so disappointed. And I just said, we're not going to let this happen again, ever. And, to go back to 69 for a second, Harmon Killebrew won the MVP that year. And early in the year, the next year, he came up to me and he says, "You should have won it." You know, which was really a first-class thing to say and do. And I said, "Well, maybe next year." So next year it happened, you know, and I didn't have as good a year. I only hit like 35 and drove in 120 or something, you know. And it was an okay year. I only hit 290 something, though. I hit 305 in 66 and 69. And, of course, when Earl took the team over in 68, he gave me the green light at first base. I don't know if you guys know that, but I stole 9 bases that year. I was pretty tricky out there. I got to second one day, and I'm standing out there, and Bill Freehand's catching. And I just went, he didn't laugh. He didn't think it was funny, you know. And that was the attitude that we had. I mean, as a group, collectively, you know, we couldn't wait till the game was over, and you know, get in. Take me about a 6-pack to get my shoes off, and then we go meet somewhere and have some lunch. And you could take 5 ball players. You could take 5 guys like any. Take any 5 guys on our team, and we'd go sit in a restaurant or sit in a lounge or something and have a couple of cool ones and say, "We're not talking baseball today." Yeah, well, then you can talk about anything you want, and then all of a sudden, we're back into what happened that day. And I swear that I learned more baseball sitting in a lounge talking to the likes of, you know, Brooksy and Frank and the rest of my teammates and guys that had been around a while. And I learned more baseball sitting in that situation than I did on the field, you know, because they'd say, "Hey, man, you know, what were you looking for when the count was 3-1 today? You shouldn't have been looking for the fastball because blah, blah, blah." So, you know, I learned pick up little things like that all the time. And over a period of time, it just kind of adds up. You know what I mean?
So I'm not as good of a storyteller as he is, but it is my job. So I got to tell one real quick story. So 2 years ago, I'm writing a story, a 50th year piece on the 70 World Series and on what Brooks meant to the 70 World Series. And I talked to Johnny Bench and Tony Perez and Palmer and Gary Nolan and a couple of Davey Johnson and Boog, of course. And I talked to Brooks for a while. And I called Boog and I said, told him what I'm doing. And I said that, you know, talk about Brooks, you know, and the amazing plays he made. And he stops me right there and says, "You know, somebody had to catch those balls." So,
if nobody catches those balls, it's E5. That's all it is to it. And he won a car from Sport Magazine. He got a new Corvette. And I said, "I want half that son of a bitch." Never did get it. But we kidded about it a lot. And, you know, I used to keep a running tab in my locker. I had a piece of paper, and every time I saved him, I put a little mark down. I think I had 30 that year. I might have lied some too, but you know. But it was just an honor and a treat to walk out on the field with Brooks Robinson every single day. Not only because I loved him as a man, but I watched the way that he worked, and he never missed anything. And a lot of people don't know it, but Brooksy took 100 ground balls every day before the game, every single day, until he was in his 30s or something. He did that for like the first 10 years in the big leagues. And there's no such thing as a bad hop. He knew every hop there was. And that's how he learned. And I tried it too, and, you know, I was okay. I was, you know, had good hands. And, you know, I wasn't real flashy, but I could get the job done.
So I'm going to jump in there. He's being modest here. He was actually a real good defensive first baseman. And his peers will tell you that. Davey Johnson will tell you that. Brooks will tell you that. But one of the interesting stories that he told me that I thought I wanted him to share with you guys is he played a little game with one of his close teammates that kind of got him warmed up. And it was really more about messing around with one of his teammates, but it ended up being a tremendous training tool. So tell me a little bit about that.
Well, Mark Blanger and I used to you know, when we'd have a rain out or we'd have a rain delay, we used to play, what was that game when you Battleship? And we used to make our own pieces of paper and do our own thing and put our numbers and all of that. And we'd do that just to kill time. But other than that, we used to play a little game called Flip. And he would get about 4 or 5 feet from me, spread his legs, and I would get on the other side and spread my legs. And we would try to throw balls between each other's legs. We should do that. And then he would get one and do it to me, and then I'd throw it back if I caught it. And then if he threw one by me, I'd have to go get it. We'd start the game again, and I'd start it. But you could put all kinds of English on a ball. I mean, you could do like that. You could do like that. You could do like that. You never knew where it was going to go or what it was going to do. And we used to do it in front of the dugout in Memorial Stadium. I think people got a bigger kick out of us doing that. I mean, they were laughing, and we were laughing, and we were sweating and having a hell of a time. And so, anyway, that was a little side story, and it helped me with my hands, with my ability to receive a ball, and all of that. It was a good game to play. So
let's go to 69 and 71. Are still, if you talk to all the guys from those years, still a disappointment because, you know, their 71 team with the 420 game winners, tremendous. That 69 team, everybody expected them to win. And I guess the question I asked you before was, what do you think went wrong? When you look back on this, what the hell happened?
Where should I start? No, in 69, I don't know. We had such a huge lead in the American. We won it by like 19 games or something like that. And I think we were flat. We just, you know, we weren't playing with all the emotion that we could have played with. And I don't know, just nothing went right. We didn't get any breaks. But like one of the Mets ball players told me, Jerry Grody said, "You guys weren't dirty." What do you mean? He said, "Well, you check our uniforms, you look at all the film, you guys were just as clean as could be. We were dirty." Okay. You know, and they got all the calls.
Oh.
They did. They had all. They got everything went their way. They really did. J.C. Martin hit a ball on top of the plate. You remember that?
Yeah.
Yeah. He was running on the grass. I couldn't even see it. And he was. And Etch is trying to throw the ball to, or Elrod was trying to throw the ball to first, and he had no shot. And there was a ball that went in the dugout, and They said that it hit his foot, and it didn't. I knew it didn't, and the hitter knew it didn't, but the ball went in the Mets' dugout, and it came out of the dugout with shoe polish on it. And Gil Hodges was standing right there. I saw him pick the damn ball up. I can't accuse him of anything, but... So anyway, just observations of that year, and it was really disappointing. And one of the greatest things that I remember happening emotionally with me is when we came back from New York and we landed at BWI at, I don't know what time it was. It was late. It was midnight or so by the time we finally got back here. And there were about 5,000 people out there on the behind a retaining fence, and they were all sitting there with their hands and fingers through the fence, screaming and hollering and crying, and we were screaming and hollering and crying. And we went over there, and I think I tried to touch every one of them because it made such an impression on me that many people came out to an airport to support us after we just got our ass kicked. I don't know, they were a good team. I mean, Milt Pappas came on the bus when we were going to New York, and he said, "Don't take these guys lightly, they can play." And they could. I'm never take anything away from them. And then, in 70, you know, we clicked, And then in 71, you know, we had four 20-game winners. You think that's ever going to happen again? I don't think so. I don't think so either. And it was just, it was great. And Pittsburgh, we beat them the first two games here, and we just went over there and lost three in a row. Have no idea why. Steve Blass really did a number on us. Really did a, he pitched two really good games against us. And, but we just, I don't know, we just, none of us were hitting. And Clemente, yeah. Clemente was okay. Yeah. And Willie Stargell was just fine, you know. He had a big home run off of McNally in one of those games that really sort of got him going. And I've always regretted that because that is one time when I thought that our team was much better than theirs. And we were. We were good. And anyway.
We showed them in
79. Yeah, you showed them in 79. Yeah, right.
Some people think that 71 team was the best team. When you look at 66, 69, 70, 71, can you distinguish one that was better than the other?
It's pretty hard. I would think that, you know, if you went back and looked at all the – you guys are the stat people. You know, you should have all the breakdown of how many got hits and this and that and this and that and blah, blah, blah. I don't mean that what you do is blah, blah, blah. If I had to pick a year, I would say that the best team was in 69. Hmm. I mean, we were good. We were really good, but we just weren't good for five games. You know, we got our ass kicked, and that's the way it is. But, if you know, when you go back in your memory bank, in the way that we felt good and everything else, but just, we just weren't, we couldn't get it done. So,
one of the questions I've always wanted to ask you, I did ask Frank this years ago, but you talked about the camaraderie of that team or that group of teams and the Kangaroo Court. Yeah. Came from there. Now, they're actually doing Kangaroo Court now with this team, with these Orioles. But how did that come about, and why do you think that was so necessary, and why was that so much fun?
I don't know if it was necessary. But, I mean, in Kangaroo Court, after the game, we only did it when we won. We didn't do it when we lost, and we had it a lot. And we would get in the clubhouse after the game was over, and Frank had this mop he put on his head. He was the judge, and we'd sit over there and call court into session. There were no riders, no outside people allowed, just ball players. And we had cases that we could. There were certain things like runner on third, you know, with less than two outs, and you didn't get him in, cost you a dollar. And, you know, if you made an error, you made a stupid play, you threw to the wrong base, probably $2. And then it expanded into personal lives. And then we started looking for stuff, you know, like a guy would scratch somewhere or something. Yeah, that'll be $2 because you were scratching your ass in center field. You know, that's the idea. You know what I mean? Yeah. And that's the kind of camaraderie that we had, and Frank was a big, big part of that. And then the writers were getting mad at us because we were keeping them out of the clubhouse, and they had their job to do. We understood that, but we had our job to do too. And most of the time, the Kangaroo Court only took like 10 minutes maybe. It wasn't a long time, but it was all part of what we did, you know, and it was And it was a lot of fun. I can't describe it any better than that. That it was fun, and I still have very, very deep feelings and love for my teammates that I had back then. It's almost like no time has passed. I mean, and I run into them, and we're losing. We've lost quite a few of them. I haven't looked at a picture of the 66 Orioles lately, but. I don't know how many of us are left. There are only a handful, I think. So, you know, it was a great life, and it was great fun.
My favorite story on the Kangaroo Court is Palmer told me that they had, for some reason or another, a toilet seat got ripped off at some point, and they painted it red, and they had the Don Buford Red Ass Award.
Red Ass Award.
That they would give to somebody.
Yeah, we had the weak swing award, you know, and there were certain guys that, and then Chico Simone was really, really funny. I mean, he would get up there and he would say, and somebody would have a funky swing, you know, he'd get fooled on a breaking ball or something and get way out in front and go, swing the bat just about that speed. And Chico would get up there and he said, he hit that ball hard. Still going to cost you a buck for a weak swing, you know. And it was if you couldn't have thin skin in this bunch, you had to have some thick skin because we were all laughing. So, and I still laugh today.
Now, one of the things that makes Boog special, as most of you guys know, there's a whole generation that don't know him as a ball player. They know him as the barbecue guy.
Yeah.
And you know, he was an absolute mainstay at Camden Yards for so many years. I want him to talk a little bit about that, why that was special to you and is special to you. But also, one of the things you told me that I thought was fascinating is, you know, we're just up on the 30th anniversary of the stadium this year. And you remember a couple weeks before the stadium was supposed to have a game, what that looked like and what your area looked like. So, I mean, it was amazing to me, like how quickly they had to come together. So tell us a little bit about that and then the whole barbecue experience.
Well, we met in November, and I was doing some, I'd been doing some Miller Lite commercials. And the Miller Lite people and the Orioles and the Miller Lite distributor here, Bobby Footlick over at Bond Distributing, got together and we had dinner one night. And we decided, I told them what I wanted to do, and they said, that sounds like a great idea. And said, why don't you come to Baltimore and get together with the executive chef. His name was Russell Zeckley. And Russell and I worked together on a menu for like about 2 months. And we did everything. We did every kind of barbecue you could imagine. And we just decided that Baltimore's a pit beef town. And, you know, that's got to be part of the program. And then being a Southern boy like I am, I mean, it's, you know, beef is not, doesn't even exist in Florida. You don't, barbecue places don't even do beef hardly, except maybe brisket, you know, but brisket's too hard. So we finally decided on doing a top round, maybe 20 pounds. They were about 20 pounds a piece. And we worked out the cooking times, and I had some grills out by the street. And they would cook them partially up in the kitchen, and they would bring them down in warming ovens, and then we would finish them off on the grill right there. And then we had slicers slicing right there. And for the first game, I think we ordered, maybe 300 pounds of beef. And we were done by the start of the game. We went through 300 pounds in like, 45 minutes. And it was all over. Our day was over. So we got to do something tomorrow. We got to do something different tomorrow. So we had 800 pounds the next day. And we lasted till the third inning. Really. And we're slicing and cooking and smoke everywhere. And we're trying to get procedure. And my son, JW, he's around here somewhere. Anyway, he was the pit master. And I would just go out there, and I'd sit on my stool and sign autographs, you know. And that's what I did, you know, and talk to people. And I did that. I did that for 28 years, and I was at almost every game. The only time that I really missed was in 97. I had colon cancer, and I went in the hospital for about a month. Well, I was out of action for about a month. And, you know, they got it all, knock on wood. And I finally went back. But that was the only time that I really missed any games. And I was out there every night. And I thought that it was important for me to be there because, you know, people would go out there and they would come by. And I had people every night that would come have dinner with me. you know, and they'd come have a sandwich and grab a beer and all that, and you know, I'd BS with them, and I knew them all by name, and we had a regular group, and Louis Tiant called me, and he says, "I want to do Cuban sandwiches in Boston." I said, "All right," and sell cigars. I said, "Okay." I said, "Do it." He said, "Well, what do you do?" I said, "I go to the ballpark every night and I sign autographs." He said, "I can't do that." I said, "Why not? What's the big deal?" "I don't do that." Anyway, he's still there. He's still there selling Cuban. I don't know if he's selling sandwiches or not, but I think he's still selling cigars. And we did a couple of Miller Lite appearances together also. He was a Miller Lite all-star. And that was another chapter of my life that was pretty interesting.
Anything else? We're going to open it up to questions pretty soon here. But anything else? Anything about your relationship with Baltimore?
The first time I came here, when we finally got here in 61, after we'd left Yankee Stadium, Hoyt Wilhelm and Skinny Brown said, "We're going to take you to eat crabs tonight, boy." And I said, "Okay." He said, "Have you ever had crabs?" I said, "No, sir, I haven't." They took me to Old O'Brickey's, and we sat down in there, and we had crabs, and that's where my love affair started with crabs, is over there. And then, you know, when you're eating crabs, that's one of the greatest, you know, there should be more corporate meetings over crabs, you know. Everybody's got their hands filthy, you know, and all this mess, and they don't have to worry about any formal crap or anything else. Just get the job done, you know. Eat, have another crab. Hell yeah. So, anyway, and my, you know, my love affair with Baltimore began then, and of course I bought a home, my first home here. Bought it on Medford Road, about 5 blocks from Memorial Stadium, and I paid, I think, $12,000 for my first house, and my payments were $125 a month. Plus, you had to pay ground rent back in those days. So I was paying another $100 a month ground rent. And I was only making $7,500. So, you know, how am I going to pay for this? And I got married, and my wife was expecting our first. And that's it. You know, pretty much we lived there for 10 years, and then we moved out to Towson. And we lived out there till the time that I left in 74 and got traded. That was one of the most disappointing days of my life, is when I got traded to Cleveland. The only positive thing about it is Frank Robinson was the manager over in Cleveland. And
the red uniforms.
What's that?
And the red uniforms.
Oh, yeah, and the red uniforms. Oh, yeah. I look real good in all red. Man. I look like a giant Bloody Mary, you know, or a runaway fire truck. They had all kinds of descriptions for me back in those days. But that, you know, Cleveland, when we played in Cleveland as visitors, there didn't seem to be too much to do. But when you played there, it's a nice town. I mean, we had a really good time there, and we enjoyed our stay there. And people used to bring me all the German population over there, around there. They do all of these worst, you know, the bratwurst, knockwurst, all of these other bolognese and all that crap. And they'd bring it. They found out I liked it. Every day there was something different at the ballpark for me. So, yeah.
I'll tell you what, we can open it up to some questions here. The microphone is right over there. If you want to stand in line, we got about 15 minutes or so. So,
we got two lines.
Yeah. We got two lines. Well, since I saw the
I'll
first one.
I'll answer to the best of my ability. That's all I can say. I can't guarantee what I'm going to say.
We'll start here, and then we'll go to you next and back and forth. So we will start here. So go ahead.
Thank you, Boog, and thank you, Dan. I'm John Miller. I'm a writer who lives in Pittsburgh. Can you talk about Earl Weaver and what he brought, and do you think those teams could have been as successful without Earl Weaver in 69 and 71?
What did you say?
He asked about Earl. About
yeah, I heard that
and he
part.
Said, he said
I don't hear so good.
Do you think they would have been as successful 69-71 without Earl?
And what did he bring that other managers could not have?
Well, Hank Bauer was our manager in 68, and I loved Hank Bauer. Hank Bauer was a right up front guy, Marine, tough dude, no BS. You went on the road, you wore a suit and a tie, and you looked like a major league ball player, not some hippie walking around in dink jeans and stuff like that. We looked good. I don't know if we were any good or not, but Earl was a coach. He was the first base coach, and then all of a sudden, Harry Dalton fired Hank Bauer at the All-Star break in 68, and then Earl came in and took over. And that's when Earl came to me and he says, "You got the green light, you know, over at first base. Take off if you feel like it." And then later on, after I hurt my wrist, putting my hands down on the ground, he said, "Don't do it anymore." He said, "I'd rather have you hitting than sliding." So I agreed. And, you know, it was when Earl came, we all knew that he was a good baseball man. I mean, I knew that he was a good baseball man, and he understood it. But he was fiery, and we saw him do some pretty unusual things in the minor leagues. You know, like covering home plate up, and he took third base with him one night. They had to call a timeout, and they couldn't find another base. That kind of stuff, you know.
Without him, I mean, what made him great? Like, without him, would the team have won 109 games? In 69.
I think so. You know, Hank Bauer said one time, he says, "I can write this lineup out any way I want. Frontwards, backwards, upside down, we're still going to kick somebody's ass." And that's what we had. That was the kind of team we had. And we didn't need anybody. I mean, and I'm not belittling anything that Earl did or said. But I personally felt like I was a self-motivated person, and most of the guys were self-motivated. I didn't need motivating.
Good morning.
Hi.
I'd like to ask about Game 4 of the 71 series, because it was notable for one thing, and that was the first night World Series game. So you guys,
right.
You had played 17 day games, and then you're up 2-1, and it's a night game all of a sudden. Did that change things? Did that? Did you foresee what that was going to do to the World Series? You know, there was never again a game in which kids listened to their radio at school.
Oh yeah. I know that the myself as a child, I remember coming home from junior high, and we didn't have a TV at home, and I used to stop in an appliance store, would have the game on, and they would have the sound coming from overhead, and that was one of my highlights, is watching World Series on the way home. And, you know, people were, you know, here, my kids would take a little radio and go to bed when they're supposed to be sleeping. They're listening to the game and stuff like that. What was your question? I'm sorry. No, the night game didn't have anything to do with it. It really didn't. It was we're professional ball players. They've got to do it too. And I don't give a damn if it's Pittsburgh or where it was. Didn't matter.
Thanks.
So, thank you. How much convincing did it take you to make that first Miller Lite commercial with Jim Hanacek?
Well, it was kind of unusual. I saw Marv Thornberry. He did the first one and said, "I still don't know why they wanted me to do this." And then Mickey Spillane and the Doll had already done one. They started like in 73, I think. And they didn't even contact me. Actually, I contacted them. I found out who it was, and I said, "I think I can do one of these." And they said, "Okay, well, we've got a script for an umpire and a ball player, and we don't have either one. Why don't you come to New York and you can read for the part and do the deal?" So I did that. They liked it. So they said, "We don't have an umpire yet." And I said, "Well, what about Jim Hanacek?" So they brought Jim Hanacek in, and he was perfect. He was, you know, he was the perfect blind type umpire, like, you know. And so we played on that, you know, and it was a, it was probably, from what I understand, it's the second most watched Miller Lite commercial of all time. And I'm pretty proud of that. And that all dried up in 88. So I had to get, that was another reason I had to come sell pit beef. But I had to reinvent myself again.
This gentleman here.
Back when you were in high school, you had a pretty good quarterback, as I recall.
That's right.
Who was a bit of a, was also a pretty good pitcher.
Damn right he was.
You want to talk about him at all?
Yes. Yeah, George Myra.
Yeah.
And he also, he was an All-American quarterback at Miami. And George threw 100 back in those days. And it was, you know, and I told him, I said, man, you ought to play baseball. His family wanted to play football, and he went up there and, you know. And then he got signed by the Giant, by San Francisco. And I ran into him at a Colt game a couple years later, and we had some fun together. But I still see George. He still lives down in Florida, and I see him every now and then. He was a very good pitcher. He was probably a better pitcher than he was a quarterback, I think.
This gentleman here?
In 64, you were the left fielder. Do you have any fond memories of playing left field that year?
There's a picture of me somewhere in Kansas City. I came running in, and I didn't dive for the ball, but I caught it, and I started stumbling towards the stands, and I couldn't stop. And I dove up into the stands, and I hit a rail like that, and I peeled off and fell on the floor and got up. And in the middle of all this, a grounds crew guy is sitting out there reading a newspaper, never looked up. Never looked up. And you know, one of the, I didn't have great speed, and I didn't catch everything in left field. But I think I had 17 assists one year playing left field. And thanks to Louis Aparicio, you know, I had a pretty good arm. And I'd cut the ball off in the gap or something, and I'd give it to Louis. Take care of him, Louis. And that's how I got 17 assists or whatever. I don't remember the number exactly.
Did you ever have to pick up a ground ball in left field with Robinson and Aparicio out there?
Very seldom. There were very few ground balls that got through on that left side. I mean, you had to have a 30-06 to get something through there. Maybe at least a 22.
This gentleman here.
On behalf of everybody, thanks so much for being here today.
Thank you. I've been looking forward to it, and I wasn't quite sure what it was going to be like or what the crowd was going to be like, but you guys have been great, and thank you for putting up with my BS.
You had the luxury of seeing Brooks for so many years, watching him take 100 ground balls a day.
Yeah.
Did you ever, in between batters, in between one of his throws, just step back and say, I don't know how the hell he did that?
You know, those plays that he made in the World Series in 70, and they call him the vacuum cleaner and all that stuff, that was a normal day. He did crap like that every single day. But, you know, nobody knew. Because, you know, the press and everything in Baltimore, we used to give him good press. But if he'd have been playing for the Yankees, he could have run for president. I'm not kidding. He was spectacular. Never missed anything. One day, I shouldn't say that. We were in Minnesota, and I think Tony Oliva hit a ball hit a ball to Brooksy at third. Threw the ball to me over my head at first. One error. Went down the right field line. A right fielder came over, picked it up, and threw it to third where Brooksy was cut, where the guy was going. Oliva ran around, went around second, went into third. They threw the ball to Brooksy, and it was right there, and Brooksy dropped it. And he took off for home. And Brooksy threw the ball home and threw it away. He made three errors on one play. He made five errors that year.
This gentleman here, we have time for just a couple more.
Could you tell us about the inside the park home run you hit in Seattle in 1969?
Absolutely.
And did
Oh, man. I can't tell you everything. To start that, the night before, Steve Barber and his wife and my wife, we went out to dinner after a Saturday night game. And, no, wait a minute, that's another story. the inside the Parker was off of Steve Barber, and Steve Barber was with Seattle at that time. And we only played 1 year at, was it Six Stadium or whatever it was? And it was raining. It was pouring. And I hit a ball off of Steve Barber. I knew it was going to be 480. And all of a sudden, I was around first, and I looked, and I said, it ain't going to make it. And then it came down. It came down in center field, and Wayne Comer was playing center field. And the ball hit like that and shot along the fence in center field, and everybody was over and right. I didn't even slide. I didn't even slide. And I talk about that quite often. I'm very proud of that. I hit 5 triples.
This gentleman over here.
Hello. I was originally going to ask about the Miller Lite commercial, but you just started talking about that before. A lot of times in players' lives when their post-playing days come upon them, they're not sure how it's going to go. I mean, I feel like in your career and life, in your post-playing days, you've evolved into a larger-than-life persona. And did you ever think during your playing days that it would be like this after your playing? Today's bobblehead day over at the ballpark. Did you ever think it would be like this?
I had no idea. I had no idea what I was in store. But after I got out of baseball, my wife kept saying, what are you going to do when you get through with baseball? And the only things that I liked to do back in those days was fish. And so we bought a marina in Key West, Florida. And I was from Key West. And we bought a marina. And then that was in 75. I was still at Cleveland. And I played ball for 2 years. And my wife was very active in the marina business. And my son, JW, he was there also. And where was I going with that?
Just how it all transpired, you know.
The Miller Lite. Then all of a sudden, I don't think I have time to tell the whole story, but there was a fishing trip. We fought a fish for 22 hours in 1979. We fought a swordfish for 22 hours, and we lost it. And the next day, I left for New York to do the commercial. And that's how that started. And to hang out with Euchre and, you know, Marv Thronberry and Billy Martin. And Billy Martin came up to me in New York, and he said, you broke my heart. You ruined my career. I said, what are you talking about? Because I hit a home run. Count was 3-2, bottom of the ninth, 2 outs, and I hit a home run off of Jim Perry to tie the game, and we went on to win the game. He said, you ruined my career. You know, and he was serious. And Billy, come on, man. So, you know, and then all of the guys were great, all from the different sports and everything else. I got real close with Ben Davidson, and there was a couple rodeo cowboys, Jim Shoulder. Jim Shoulders was he was a bull riding champion, and he showed me all the gore holes he had in him. Really. I mean, where the bulls had gored him and gone all the way through him and stuff like that. And, it was a good bunch of guys. Bubba and Butkus and all of, you know, it was just fun.
Unfortunately, I was told we have time for just one more, and it has nothing to do with a guy wearing a Yankee shirt that's second back. That's just pure coincidence, I swear. So we have one more, this gentleman here, and then we're going to finish it up.
I'm from Williamsport, and I wanted to ask you what the experience of being with that 54 Lakeland team was like in Little League World Series, and what that might have done for your later life and experience, and what it might have done. done to help you?
Yeah, that's a good question. I meant to get to that, but, you know, we just seemed to run out of time a little bit. But I was 12 years old. I was a real good pitcher. I could bring it. I had a good arm. And we were half of our Little League team in Lakeland, Florida. We were the Orange League. And we won Florida. We went to North Carolina. I pitched 2 games in 3 days. And we beat Tennessee and Kentucky. And the third game we beat, I don't remember. Anyway, to go to Williamsport. Then we got on a train in Rocky Mount, North Carolina, and went to Williamsport in the train. And didn't know what to expect there. We played Schenectady, New York, in a game. And these guys were bigger and stronger and faster. We never seen anything like that. And I was pitching. And I got beat 16-0. So they kicked my ass. And I couldn't lift my arm for almost 2 years. And that's why they have all the rules in Little League Baseball now that you don't only pitch so many innings and so many days. But I pitched every day. I didn't care. And my stepbrother, Carl Taylor played, you know, for Kansas City and played for St. Louis. And he was a pretty good catcher. And he made it to the big leagues. But he was my catcher. And he told me right out. He said, you shouldn't even be out here. And I got a base hit, and that was it. And I just sort of, you know, evolved.
All right, guys.
Thank you.
Okay. Thanks so much. Appreciate doing this. And Boog Pal, thanks again.